Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it?
1999. Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from the Staten Island Ferry on our way to the wall here in 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nyborg.
I'm Phil Isco.
And with us today is a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, Kemiando Catino.
Yes.
Kemi, great to have you.
I'm bringing the black to the white. See what I did there?
Thank you. Yeah. Kemi's a writer, producer, director, actor. Produced numerous shorts. Wrote on Undressed. Wrote on Step Up. Writes on Step Up. Started an episode of Little America. I think you have more credits than anyone we've done, or at least more. More slashes.
Oh yeah, but you know the slashes are a gift and a curse, because like
people think
you're just like mildly good at each of them.
Jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah,
in my life.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Being a multi hyphen, it's pretty impressive. I mean.
You know what it is? You got to put actress last. Because when people are like, actress, writer, director, they're like, oh, you didn't get any jobs. Which is true, but they don't need to know that.
that's a great way of looking at it.
Yeah.
I know you are good at all of those things. I don't know if you're good at podcasting. So I guess we'll find out.
Oh, okay. The pressure. Actually, I produce podcast.
I have watched and listened to Issa Vibe. So I am well aware that I was not flying blind when I asked you to come on. I knew what I was getting into. It kept me as very good. Issa Vibe on your Instagram.
Yeah.
But it's a flirting show. You get it? Yes.
You know what? I'm trying to sell it. So whoever wants to buy it, that's where you're gonna find it. Okay. This is my shameless plug.
So what is this podcast about?
Oh, I'm producing a different podcast, but I have an IGTV show where I get two people to just flirt with each other, because I feel like the art of flirting is dying, you know, like I was getting eggplant emojis in my DM. What the fuck am I supposed to do with that? Can I cuss? Can I cuss? Am I allowed to cuss on this?
Absolutely.
I watched the one you posted this week. It was so cute. I mean, like, it's just so sweet the way it's actually really, really sweet and kind of life affirming to watch people flirt with each other.
It is.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect it. I thought it was going to be more funny, but it was really, I think there's something about the pandemic and people are not connecting with people as much, and giving a space for people to connect and say, that's why you're here, has started to feel like a little bit more endearing than I thought it would be, you know?
Yeah.
So it's been fun.
Well, it's like, you know,
I gotta check that out. I gotta watch that.
Yeah. It's not, obviously, this movie is not in any way romantic, but
not in any way.
But like every show, I'm sorry, it's like a meet cute, and it's really kind of sweet to see people break through barriers and you know, catch each other's rhythms, and like, I don't know, I think it's really cool, Kemi. So I didn't realize obviously it's an IGTV show, not a podcast, but same kind of vibe.
Yeah, same kind of vibe. It's a vibe.
Mm-hmm. It's a vibe.
So is this movie's a vibe, guys.
You know, it's some sort of vibe.
It's some sort of vibe. I don't know what vibe it is, but it's going for something.
Opening shot, I was like, this is wild. Okay. Yeah. What the fuck is going on?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That, I think
I
that
can
was...
describe the opening shot. I'm not afraid of anything. The opening shot. The opening shot follows three young black kids in Central Park as they, you know, they're just kind of rapping back and forth, really apropos of nothing, as they hide behind a couple of trees where you see a full-on naked Central Park threesome being guarded by two white girls, black guy, being guarded by a fourth person, another guy, with a gun to make sure that anybody who is potentially watching this threesome, runs away when that guy points his gun at them.
Which he does to the three children that were rapping as they peep on what's happening.
And then right after that, one of the white girls is like, and let me finish you, and I'll finger you. Did you know, did you catch that?
Yep.
Right at the end?
I caught it, yeah.
And then the next scene is her, we don't usually get to the plot this fast, but the next scene is her going back to her, like, obviously like $10 million penthouse. Yep. And her mother is Marla Maples.
Just so this uppity, movie, uppity.
Yeah, movie is, that's in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, this movie's wild. So before we get into the movie, Kemi, we like to ask people on this podcast, where were you in 1999?
Ooh, 1999. I was in what they call primary school. I was in Swaziland. I was about to start. Y'all gonna find out how young I am. I was about to start interviewing for high school, but our system is different. It's like 7 years primary school, 7 years high school. But I think something that is interesting about 1999. Is I was in grade five. I think that's actually when I started feeling horny for the first time, if I think about it.
The big year. Yeah.
It was a big year. I think that's the year I started to be like, ooh, what's going on over here? So I would say 1999 started my lifelong relationship with horniness.
Man, I thought it was a big year, but it was a really big year. I mean, for movies, but I mean, so but do you too. Remember?
That's also when I started feeling horny.
Some
and I'm
of
much
these
older
films
than
made
you.
It out.
No.
Why did y'all choose 1999?
There are so many good movies this year. Like, it really just it comes down to something very simple. Phil and I hung out a lot. Phil and I have been friends for 15 years. And our relationship basically consisted of eating breakfasts, brunches, or lunches and talking about movies. And we, oh, you know, Phil's a writer as well. And we always came back to just kind of the phenomenon that was like, why did all of these incredible movies break through in 99? And then as we've gone further and further down this rabbit hole, like, there does seem to be a real interesting cultural shift that happened in 1999. Could be Clinton and could be, you know, the millennium. It could be changing exhibition models and distribution models. And there's an indie it's kind of that moment when indie was just about to be mainstreamed, when the big companies were taking over. So you had these movies like I mean, for instance, being John Malkovich and Magnolia and The Insider and all these movies that would have been made for like $10 million or $5 million getting made for like $50 million or $60 million. So there's just something really cool and interesting about the moment for us that that excited us. And we really think it's necessary if you're going to do this not to pick and choose. So you have to do it.
And also, as we've discussed, but I mean, it sort of was all media, which is what Kenny and I have sort of discovered as we've gone deeper and deeper down this rabbit hole. Like, you know, the fact that you have The Sopranos and The West Wing premiering both in 1999, you're really seeing this moment when, you know, cable becomes real and broadcast becomes outdated. And that in conflict with the studio system versus the indie system, like it's all kind of, for whatever reason, all sort of crescendoing at this moment. So it was really exciting to explore.
And musically, it's also like kind of the last moment that like things were really siloed.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like we did a Britney Spears episode and we're about to do Rage Against the Machine episode. So like, it's like things were very like if you look at the charts, you never would have what you have today, like these crossover artists doing different styles with, you know, with different kind of artists or the same five producers producing like everything from, you know, rock bands to rap music to dance music. So it is kind of a last gasp for the siloed off music.
Yeah, it feels like. Yeah, to your point, it really does feel like genre doesn't so much exist after this point in the same way that it did before.
At least not in the mainstream.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And not to have a hacky transition, but that kind of speaks to this movie. Like this movie, if I putting sort of what it's trying to say as effectively or ineffectively as it might very well be doing in this film, just to look at the way the film is made, like that was the thing that I found perhaps the most, I don't want to say disappointing because that's the wrong word, but that was the thing that hit me the most, which was to pull off something like this, a mosaic of all of these different stories, a good chunk of them being improvised, and have any sense of cohesion is incredibly difficult. Like this is a very high bar that he's striving for. And I appreciate the swings and I appreciate what he attempted to do. I don't know how successfully he did it, in my opinion, but it really, like, I kept thinking about Magnolia, and that's the wrong movie to think about from a really in any way, shape, or form. But just because of how big the cast was, how sprawling it sort of was in its own way, the sort of collapsed time period of it, because it feels like the whole thing takes place over a matter of days, maybe. Like it feels like it really takes place in a short
like a week.
Something like that. So it really is just sort of this really condensed, crazy movie that's very kitchen sinky in terms of like trying to put everything he's ever thought about race and America and youth and all of it. And yeah, I mean I'm still not entirely convinced that I know how I feel about it, if I'm being completely honest.
You know what I did appreciate about, in terms of like how it, like the look of it, it looked like a 90s music video. Like if you look at it through the lens of like, this is what 90s music, especially R&B music videos, it felt like one long 90s music video, which I thought was like, and I feel this way about Empire. Empire feels like one long music video that lasted seven seasons. I don't know what season they're in. But I think when you start looking at it in that way, because at first I was kind of like, oh, okay. You know, because music videos have the tropes, right? And so I kind of appreciated that. I think the most meta thing for me was like his commentary on race was pretty spot on, to be honest, and can still live on today. But as a white man writing and directing, it's just like, you're doing the thing. You're doing the thing you're commenting on. And so that's what I was just like, this is wild. This is wild. Like, you literally are doing the thing you're commenting on. Wild.
Do you think that he was aware of that?
And this is what I often wonder about people who do this, because there's a lot.
Yeah.
I don't.
You're talking to one.
I often think that they see themselves, you know, like, I think they sort of see themselves as like the Eminem of movie making. And sure. So I think they're like, I have this insider info, so I can do it. And I can make this, I call them woke whites, okay? That's what I call them, woke whites. But it was just so fascinating because I do think a lot of the points he brought up, especially with the girl, and like, to me, the movie's main message is people love Black culture, but not Black people, you know? And I was just like finding it fascinating that a white man wrote and directed this and yet was rightfully speaking on all the things, but simultaneously doing the thing.
We've spoken about that, you and I, Kemi, that notion, right? And, you know, I've had to kind of check myself and humble myself in terms of what, why I feel like I can write the stories I can write. So I think I have just a little insight into what's going on. And I think a lot of it came through to me. And again, there we can touch on how horrible James Toback is and how horrible Brett Ratner is. And but there's something about the when Brett Ratner is directing Raekwon's video. Mm-hmm. And he's sitting in Video Village, and they have the shot of him in Video Village, and he's dancing like this, right?
Yeah.
And he thinks he's like, he's allowed to dance like that, right? Like, he's like, I get this music. Brett Ratner is again, no judgment, super rich kid from Miami. He even says that basically in the movie, you know?
Yeah.
But he thinks that he thinks he's been given a pass. And that's a notion that like was pretty prevalent until like about 18 months ago, right? The idea that there are a lot of white people who think they have been given a pass that decided themselves they were given the pass. Does that make sense?
It does.
Like I hesitate to walk too far into this water, you know, because I risk being one of these people myself. But like, I watch a lot of ESPN, and there's a basketball player named Alex Caruso, a white guy in the Lakers, and he was talking to Kendrick Perkins, who's like this, you know, somewhat famous retired player. He played with LeBron, and he's like, he's a commentator on ESPN. He's very smart, and he was interviewing Alex Caruso, and Alex Caruso was saying all the right things about race, you know, in this current moment. And Kendrick Perkins said at the end of it, he goes, look, we're not giving out any invites to the cookout right now, but if we are, you'll be the first one to get it. And I think that's the way that's I think white people thought they were always welcome at the cookout if they felt like it.
Yeah.
And that goes further, right? That goes further into like the way white people have not just appropriated the culture, the way white people have come in and just said, yeah, we love this shit, we'll take it now.
Yeah.
I mean, you see it in obviously it's most apparent, at least within the story of the movie, with the kids, with the Bijou Phillips and specifically
Hoffman,
her character,
Elijah
and
Wood.
Just this idea of like, I want to be black, so I should be allowed to be black.
Yeah. But not just that. Like, she even says, like, I'm a kid. This is just a phase. I'm gonna do it. And then when I don't want to do it, I don't have to do it. But
right.
Kids. And again, fascinating, because that's so true. It's like, yeah, you do get to put on this like, I'm ghetto and speak like this. But then when the cops come, you can take it off, you know, you can take it off real fast, like a real costume. And I appreciated that awareness that she kept speaking of, you know. I don't think she realized what she's saying, but I do think it's very interesting to see how white culture will love black people until it's dangerous to them. And also the awareness that they can take it on and take it off, you know. It's the same shit that's happening on TikTok.
Yeah. All over the place. But that's what happens at the end of the movie. So not to jump ahead, but that's kind of what we
do.
At the end of the movie, you literally have a white person committing a crime against a black person for a black person.
Yeah.
Who is in such a privileged position that he can commit murder and get away with it.
Yeah.
So it's this, I'm of two very, very polarized minds about this movie, because he seems to be, James Toback in this movie seems to be very aware of what white people are doing.
Right.
And the ways white people are fucking up. But I don't think he gives the black people in this movie any agency. And I think there's something really kind of deeply insidious about the way some of the black people are portrayed,
yeah,
particularly rich. Like there's something really, really kind of, and I'll just jump to it. Like there's this idea, and Kimmy, I feel like this is more your wheelhouse. You've been talking about this all season. So I'm cribbing a lot of like your notes. But there's this idea that like, you know, for decades and decades, white people have been making movies and television shows about black people, yes, but they've always put them in subordinate positions, you know, whether it's slavery, whether it's, you know, home help, like the help, I mean, whether it's, you know, criminals, things like that. And I think that there's something insidious about this idea of the character, I believe his name was Will, right? The older brother who wound up killing... Will wants to quote unquote be black, but he is not quote unquote black until he commits a crime, commits a murder. And then as soon as he, like, that's what being black is. Like, you want to be black, that's how you be black. And
even
that's
the,
what's
even the white
insidious.
Kids think he's the most black white guy.
They
like,
say
they
that.
Talk about him in that way.
Yeah. And it, I noticed that within like 20 minutes though, like the idea of blackness is like, oh, I smoke weed, I do drugs, oh, I speak with Ebonics. And even their understanding of Ebonics is not really Ebonics, it's just like broken grammar. And so I think I noticed that and it bothered me, but it's also how people think, right? And so I did feel conflicted in that. But what, to your point, he manages to put an array of white people in that movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and even as that line where the black guy's like, you can't lump all white people together, right? When he's talking about his girlfriend, he's like, she's different. And I feel like there was a variety of white people. You had the white uppity uppy, you had all these people, but I feel like all the black people were the same. And I don't know that he, like, I think there was a chance to make at least one of those characters or two of those characters go against the stereotype of black people. Because I do think, actually, you have more freedom to roll with a stereotype when there's an array of people, if that makes sense.
So there, I thought about that, too, and just, like, doing a quick audit. There was the Vanity Fair writer, one-scene character, who was going to write the profile on Joe Pantoliano.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then there was, I don't know who she was, like Rich's ex-girlfriend or Rich's something.
Yeah.
Girlfriend, the other,
girlfriend.
Like,
yeah,
Rich's conscience who comes every once in a while and says, you know, don't be a bad boy. But outside of those two characters, they all kind of fit into these stereotypical boxes we put black people into. But the thing that's come clear to me, and it's interesting to do this movie at this moment in history, because like, again, from a white person's perspective, what's happening right now seems to be black people have been saying the same things for a very long time, and white people are just finally listening. Like nothing is really, to me, really changing about the way black people are presenting their ideas. It's just that, you know, someone got murdered on camera for 9 minutes and a lot of people woke up. So I think maybe 5 years ago or maybe 20 years ago, I might have watched this movie and I might have said, so these white kids in, you know, and I was this exact age, these white kids in New York. I was in New York at this time, had a lot of friends who were white kids in private schools who wouldn't have been so open about their desires to be black. Like that was a little over the top, but that's not really so important. Like there's so much appropriation going on. It was crazy. So you would have put out a film like this and a white audience might have said, all right, that's kind of weird. And that's kind of like, you know, not what we want our kids to be doing, but what do we do about it? What do we do about these, you know, because like when she says it's just a phase, like, yeah, well, it's okay. It is like maybe just a phase for her, but it seems very clear to me what you do about it is you stop treating Black people and Black culture like it is a fucking outfit to put on. Like it's wearing, you know, like it's wearing a costume, and that showed that these are actual, it's embarrassing because it's so simple, but these are actually people with an actual culture that you don't get to just put on and put off. And if you do want to like be a tourist in Black culture, do your research, earn your way in. So,
I mean, I just think it's like, also if we go real, real big with it, if you look at America, one of the biggest exports is Black culture, right? It's the music, it's the film, it's the style. Like that is a big export, and America wears it like a costume because, like I said, people love Black culture. Like a lot of people be like, I love Black culture. Yeah, you do, but you don't love Black people, because where were those people? If you look at all those white kids at the end, where were they? You know, and I think especially the girlfriend, her just like, oh yeah, he got killed or did that, even though she was part of it, to me that represents, I love Black culture, I want to be with the baller, but I don't actually give a fuck about the person, you know.
And just it's the, more the Claudia Schiffer character that we're talking about. Sorry, I just went
don't ask me actors names, don't call me out, don't call me out. I will.
Kevin, you're in a position to speak to that a little bit more than almost any guest we've ever had. As a kid, you grew up primarily in Uganda, but also Swaziland?
No, at 1999, I was in Swaziland. So at 3 weeks old, I went to Swaziland. I was supposed to go to South Africa. My dad is really light-skinned and can pass for white. So they told him he wouldn't be able to live with his... Talk about Black and white. They told him, you won't be able to live with your kids and your wife. So he had a job, everything. And then they were like, that's your wife and kids. You won't be able to live in the same. So it's just at the end of apartheid that we moved. So then he was like, fuck that. So we moved to Swaziland. And that's why I ended up there.
And you were there through, I actually don't know this, but you were there through how old?
So I was there till 13. Well, my family was there till 13. They moved back to Uganda when I was 13, but I was still in boarding school in Swaziland. So I would go back and forth. So I'd be at school, and then every 3 months I'd go back home for a month for holidays and so forth.
So in terms of the American media you got as a child, what was the American media you were getting? Film, television, music, whatever.
That's very interesting, because I think, you know, I've been having a lot of discussions about people. There is a little bit of a divide between Africans and African Americans that's being talked about, especially diaspora. And what I always tell people is, as Africans, we consume the same media that y'all consume, right? We're consuming the mass media that America is putting out. So we're watching films like this and being like, oh, thug, 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 thug. We too are also like, I love Black culture. Don't want to be arrested, you know? And so what happens is when people come here, they have their kids, they try to make a divide with their kids. And so they'll be like, no, you're not Black, you're African. Like you're special, you're different. And so I think that's where that divide starts on the immigrant side. I think the same thing that happens on the other side, in that Americans consume the same media. So when you're seeing Africans are poor, Africans are backwards, Africans are this, they're also receiving that. So then they tell their kids, oh, you're not African, you're African-American. And so that divide starts. And so basically we consume media like a white person back home. And, there is a lot of ignorance about the African-American history. Like, why wasn't I taught African-American history? Because it is an extension of my history, you know, to see it as different. Those are our people, you know. And so we basically consume it like white people. We love Black culture, could care less about Black people. And that's a huge generalization, of course. But I do think that because we are just consuming what is given out. I think now less so with social media, because everyone with Twitter and Instagram, I think people are, you know, consuming from the horse's mouth. But in 1999, we were watching all the films that y'all were watching, you know?
Mm-hmm. And then you came here in you came here for college when you were 18 or for acting 18. School when you were 18?
No.
I was in Georgia, Oregon, or?
Yeah, I was in Portland, Oregon. I was an overnight mm-hmm. minority. Could not be at a whiter place. Wow. Yeah. What a time. It's like I flew from Uganda and landed in Portland. Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I went to San Francisco, then LA, mm-hmm. then back home, then came back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's I incredible. Remember being obsessed with black movies. Like in the 2000s, I remember being obsessed and like, just wanting that life, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember, like, I watched Love and Basketball 150 times, you
it's
know.
It's so good. It's such a great movie.
Yeah. But then you come here and you're like, oh, you land in Portland.
That is not Love and Basketball, let me tell you. That is, wow. Let me give a very brief synopsis of the movie just for the people that haven't seen it. Rich Bauer, played by Oliver Power Grant, is an up-and-coming star in the hip-hop world. Everyone wants to be around him, including Charlie, played by Bijou Phillips, and her fellow upper-class white high school friends, played by Elijah Wood and Gabby Hoffman. The growing appeal of black culture among white teens fascinates documentary filmmaker Sam, played by Brooke Shields, who sets out to chronicle it with her husband, Terry, played by Robert Downey Jr. But before Bauer is a rapper, he was a gangster, and his criminal past comes back to haunt him and all of those around him. It was written and directed by James Toback. It first screened at the Telluride Film Festival on September 4th, 1999, and would eventually get theatrical release in April of 2000. It would go on to make $5 million on a $15 million budget. The movie has 39% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 30% from audiences. I want to read a very brief snippet of Roger Ebert's 2-star review of the movie, where he said, like James Toback himself, his new film is in your face, overflowing with ideas, outrageous in his connections, maddening, illogical, and fascinating. But also, like its author, it's never boring. Toback is the brilliant wild child of indie cinema, now a wild man in his 50s, whose films sometimes seem half-baked, but you like them that way. The agony of invention is there on the screen. The characters in his movie slide easily in and out of various roles with sex as the lubricant. Toback's camera follows one character into a situation and another out of it, gradually building a mosaic. Black and white is not smooth and well-oiled, not fish, not fowl, not documentary, not quite fiction, and not about any single theme you can pin down. Those are points all to its credit.
Yet 2 stars.
2 stars. I think that just for context, the James Toback situation in terms of his career and some things that he's done kind of came to a head in the Me Too situation in 2017. On October 22nd, 2017, the Los Angeles Times reported that 38 women have accused Toback of sexual harassment or assault. Toback denied these allegations, saying he had not met the women, or if he had, it was for 5 minutes, about which he had no recollection.
A lot of famous women on that list, too.
Yes. Rachel McAdams, Selma Blair, Julianne Moore, to name a couple. The alleged harassment occurred at meetings framed as interviews or casting auditions in places such as hotel rooms, movie trailers, or a public park, where Toback asked questions pertaining to the women's sex lives and rubbed his crotch or masturbated in front of them. He claimed that he was taking medication at the time, so these assaults were quote-unquote biologically impossible. Since the article was published, 357 additional women contacted the Los Angeles Times and said Toback has sexually harassed them.
Wow. I was about to say, before you mentioned that, is much like the way he treats black characters, the female characters are just like product on both sides, right? It's just like the white girls are just there to, like, I had no idea. I had no idea why they were there, why they were at the party, but it was just like, here, white girls. Yeah. And same with that scene where you see him with the 2 black girls And so it just, they felt like currency in many ways. Mm-hmm. Whereas I feel like he could have, if he really wanted to explore race dynamic, he could have explored that phenomenon of Black men with white women, which I think is fascinating. But it just felt like none of the women, I'm not shocked, is what I'm saying.
It's funny because I talk about dialectics a lot. The idea that two things could be true at the same time, two seemingly opposing ideas could be true at the same time. Two things come to mind for James Toback. Mm-hmm. One is the classic, can you separate the art from the artist? And I've really come down on the side of you almost have to, or else you're going to be searching out people who are bad people all through everything you do. And you really, it's going to be very hard. You're going to have a hard time consuming anything. And even more so, you don't have to be a good person to make art, period. Right? Like, art from bad people is also relevant because it exists in the world. You don't get to pick and choose the people in the world. You don't get to pick and choose the artists in the world. So
sorry to interrupt. I just have a quick question. Do you have like a line that like where you're like, but that I can. Like with me, R. Kelly, I can. I can.
Probably be something it would probably be something personal. And I would also say that like there's a difference between enjoying something and valuing it, right? So like I can't enjoy Michael Jackson's music anymore like I used to. But I still recognize what he put out, how valuable it is, and what it influenced, and that there are also appropriate uses of a lot of his songs. And I'm not just talking about, in film or whatever. Man in the Mirror does not lose its value because Michael Jackson is a piece of shit. Like, it's a piece of art about someone else. About a character.
And to add to that, I might get canceled, but I can consume Michael Jackson's art and I cannot consume R. Kelly's songs because R. Kelly is singing about the shit, R. Kelly is singing about I'm forgetting the lyrics about you might be young. That's not R. Kelly. It's fine. But he's talking about the shit he's doing. And so when I consume it, I'm like, this is about a 14-year-old girl versus Michael Jackson. Like, to your point, Man in the Mirror, I'm not, he not singing about the shit he's doing. The art is not reflecting him.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
go ahead,
Phil. I have similar feelings to what you guys are talking about, and for me, I mean, I guess Woody Allen is probably one of the biggest ones to point at, which is that he was incredibly influential on me as a teenager and as a kid. I still think some of his films are brilliant, but to your point, Kemi, like I can't really watch Manhattan now and see that relationship with Mariel Hemingway and say, oh, that's okay. It's just not okay anymore. So to your point, Kenny, and I think it's a very, very, very valid one, which is you can respect something, you can see the inherent talent in something and not enjoy it as much as you used to. And I think that's where I land on a couple things.
So that Woody Allen point kind of brings me to my second point, which is James Toback is at the same time a astute critic of white people entering black spaces and a white person entering black spaces. So, and this is, it's the most interesting thing about this movie when it comes to this particular argument or this particular, notion is that James Toback played the recording studio owner.
Yeah.
He played a person who wanted the cool of black music in his life, but when he's sitting there with a white person, is making it very clear, all right, I want all the spoils that come with what Wu-Tang brings. We should talk about the Wu-Tang element as well, but all the spoils that come with what Wu-Tang brings, but none of what inspired or gave birth to these stories in my studio.
Right.
For someone to write that and play that character, obviously, I think he knew to some extent what he was doing with making the movie. Now, to your point, the point you're making, Kemi, about the white women in and around the black parties, there are spots that he obviously has a blind spot about, that he thinks are part of the spoils when they're actually part of the problem. And that's the thing about the Woody Allen thing that made me, you know, kind of connect these two things, which is Woody Allen is very aware of a lot of his failings, right? It comes across in his movies all the time. That's not a failing he was aware of, that, you know, his chasing of like 18-year-olds or 17-year-olds or 16-year-olds, he never presented that as a personal problem. He just presented that as a healthy adult relationship. Just like James Toback here is not presenting like white women being used in these black spaces as essentially living statues without actually interrogating it. That's just part of the music video aesthetic to him. So it's really like I actually do like, you know, again, separating the art from the artist, I give him great credit for talking about these things that no one even fucking acknowledged in 1999, like on this scale with this budget. And also, like, he also perpetuated a lot of bad things in this movie that maybe he should have known better about. So,
yeah. I think that's how I felt, because watching it, I'm like, oh my God, this is what's going on today. And no one is talking about it. I think, as I said in the beginning, the meta experience is like, but you're doing it, which is like very weird. But I think going back to why people give themselves a pass or give themselves their own invite to the cookout is I think he feels that, oh, because I'm commenting on it, I'm allowed to be in this space because I'm so aware of it. But to go to the Me Too thing, I think just like what you're talking about with Woody Allen, why have Mike Tyson there talking about rape cases? You know, like, that is weird. That is super weird. And I think that leans into the R. Kelly side for me about, like, you're kind of justifying it. And it was just weird. It was just weird to have Mike Tyson.
I kind of want to challenge you to answer your own question, because I am very interested in trying to figure out America's obsession with post-rape, post-prison Mike Tyson. And there are three major players in this who have normalized Tyson. Obviously, The Hangover is one.
Yeah.
Which made him cute and cuddly. Jimmy Kimmel is another. Someone who I have like incredible respect for, but Jimmy Kimmel used him as a mascot and made him cute and cuddly. And James Toback, who initially normalized him in this movie as almost like a Yoda-like character.
Yeah.
And then made a feature-length documentary about Mike Tyson
that
humanized him and gave his side of the story and didn't present the other person's side of the story. Now, I think Mike Tyson is endlessly fascinating. But I think people have, just like with Kobe, people have erased what he did and commodified him in a way that I kind of can't figure out. So I wonder what you think, Kemi.
I think it's a fascination with athletes, right? I think black male athletes, I mean, it's like OJ. This is all an extension of like OJ stuff. I think when you're making white America a lot of money, you're going to have the system defending you. You know, I just think it's as simple as that. And I think, I don't know what the fascination is. And I think to bringing up the idea that he made this whole documentary, basically humanizing him, I think goes back to me saying, it's weird given that he was doing the same shit, you know? Yeah. And it feels like I'm going to present this side so that I myself can justify my actions. See, we're not bad people, but you're saying it through the lens of someone else. And it's like, I'm going to use this story so you humanize with him, but I actually think it's him trying to humanize himself to himself, you know? I think Mike Tyson as a person is fascinating because, like, he's like really strong and like he's a boxer. And then also when he talks, he has a childlike element because, one, he has a lisp. And I think that also talks to how we view people with speech impediments. And I think it's like that dichotomy that has people like super fascinated. Didn't he have a show? Yeah. You know, he had a show. I don't know if it's going to go on
Broadway.
No, a TV show about his wheat farm. I had a friend working on it. I wonder if it went through.
He might have, because he had a animated show on Adult Swim called Mike Tyson Mysteries. You know, there's a third element to what you're talking about with Tyson that is just so seemingly incongruous. Is, and Toback obviously like is enthralled by this. Big strong man kicks the shit out of people. You know, from a really really hard upbringing, an unusually difficult upbringing. Childlike voice and some childlike tendencies, like very sweet with animals, for instance. Yeah. Right? Raises pigeons.
What?
Three, as a child, he raised pigeons on his roof.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
And when he wasn't committing armed robberies, which he also
did. Right, right.
So, and three, look past all of that. Write down his words on a piece of paper. Eloquent, insightful, existential. Like, he doesn't fit into any of our stereotypical boxes about anything. So I do think, you know, he is incredibly fascinating. And there are some tragic elements to it. But your point about Toback making this and essentially saying, let me give the rapist side of the story, because, you know, rapists are people too, is really, you know, kind of insightful and makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, I think that go ahead. Sorry, Cammy.
I was going to ask, what happened with his case? I don't actually really know. Like,
convicted. See, I think he served three years of a 5-year sentence, maintained his innocence throughout. However, like and has always maintained his innocence on that case, but has also admitted to a lot of other really terrible things, including, you know, assaulting Robin Givens when they were together and robbing people when he was younger. Like,
wow.
It's confusing. And frankly, like, I think that, you know, I think if a more responsible filmmaker got their hooks into this, kind of like Ezra Edelman did with OJ, with the 10-part series, there's something there to be kind of dissected, but not Toback.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I mean, the Toback thing, hearing you guys talk about all of this really makes me think about sort of his, you know, this idea that you guys have been talking about, this idea of white people just thinking that they can go to the cookout, this confidence that comes with this, the confidence it takes to make a movie like this, and then the confidence to think that it's okay to do what he did in his actual life to various women. It all speaks to this sort of like toxic, not just toxic masculinity, but toxic power. This idea that Toback has sort of convinced himself of to some degree or another, which led to this film, which also feels like it's kind of about that. Like, it's all this weird kind of hard to describe. It's very strange.
Because even the documentary filmmaker, Brooke Shields, right?
Yep.
See? I got one name. Look at me go. But it's like the same thing. It's like, why is she documenting it? Why is she the one who's like interested in the story? And why is she the person who's going to control the narrative? And it didn't seem like she was doing much work. Even her questions were just like, I don't know, that they were that reflective. And it felt like actually, and this is the meta part of it, it felt like she was using that as a way to get into those spaces that she wanted to be part of.
Look at her hair.
I was just going to say, can we talk about her dreadlocks for a second?
Exactly. So she's like, it's the same, it's like a little bit like the same thing happening. It's like when you see someone holding a photo, holding a photo, holding a photo, holding a photo.
Yeah.
That's but what I felt like.
I have a question for you guys, because I found myself fascinated with Brooke Shields' character in this movie. It made me think about Nicole Kidman in To Die For when she's doing the documentary with Joaquin Phoenix and Casey Affleck. Yeah. In To Die For, it's a dark comedy, right? Like, it's a commentary on this woman who thinks that she understands kids or wants to understand them and is doing a sort of pseudo-gritty documentary. In this, I can't tell if Brooke is in on the joke or not, or if it's a joke. Now, again, that might be emblematic of the movie as a whole, but I just can't, like, I was watching it being like, is Brooke Shields great in this, or is she terrible in this? Like, I couldn't tell if it was like, if there was a consciousness to the performance or not.
That's a good anyway, question.
Phil, this is one of the most layered movies we've done, and part of what's so interesting about it is you can't tell how many layers were intended and how many layers we've built on it in the course of this conversation and the last 20 years of history and society.
Yeah.
I want to take on that question if you don't mind. Kelly.
Go for it.
Go.
I think that she did a great job. I also think she is a like ruthless caricature of, as Kemi put it, the woke white.
Yeah,
sure. And I think it's pretty cheesy to have a woke white do that to another woke white. So, like, I think like
that's fair.
I think it's just it's. Like in a weird way, like this movie had to exist so someone did it, and then you could say you shouldn't do this, but like you could hold it up and be like, all right, here's an example of what you shouldn't be doing. Like I don't like the what help.
I have a question. If you had watched that movie, because I've had this experience before and I won't mention the movie, I went to a screening last year of a movie. Kenny might know because I came back and was like, this is the best movie I've ever watched, okay? Ever. And
I want to talk about this.
The director's name sounds black. Let's just say he has a name like
Kenny Nybart.
Let's just say he has a name like Tyrone. Let's say it's, so, they're introducing the movie. They're like, this new director, Tyrone, blah, blah, blah. So I'm watching it through the lens of a black director and a black writer. And so I'm like, this is fascinating. I noticed some of the, slight stereotypes over there, but I'm like, that might be his experience. And so I let everything pass, and I have the most beautiful cinematic experience I've had in the longest time of my life. I come back to the room. I tell these people, y'all have to watch this movie. Y'all have to watch this movie. And then I find out the director and writer is white. And it's the first time in my life that I had a post experience of a movie, because then I had to go through all those images again and be like, that's not okay. That's not okay. And I'm really conflicted. And so I wonder if we
I feel like I saw you doing that in real time.
Yeah,
I felt like I saw it like
And imagine for that to be the best cinematic experience of your life, you know? And so I wonder if we watched the same movie and it was done by a Black person, because that's not what I've started to do, would we feel the same way we feel?
You know, I'm going to make you feel bad, Kemi. But for like 6 months, like I've referred to that story in my head. I'm like, all right, there is a way. There is a way. I mean, like, it broke, and I'm like, ah, oh, there's no way. But I was like, wait, there is that one movie where the guy.
You know what? No, you know what? Have you watched Last Black Man in San Francisco?
Also yes. Made by a white guy. Yeah,
yeah.
Loved it, and I still love it.
Very good movie. Yeah,
I still love it. There is a way. There is a way. It's here's my thing, and this will always be my thermometer. If your friends look like a line of coke, don't do it. Don't do it. Because that man's best friend is the main Black guy. And you can tell people, not that if you hang out with Black people, you understand Black people. But I do think there was like, you can see in the writing of it, there was so much nuance. And then he saw those characters as people.
Kemi, have you ever subtweeted on a podcast before?
That's what we're doing right now.
I'm not subtweeting you.
I know that wasn't directed at me.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's all. But back to the question: if this was directed by a Black person, written by a Black person, how do you think we would consume this?
I think we're talking about a very different film, right? I mean, yeah. We're talking about,
say it's not for the sake of the argument, because I think okay. that's Kemi's point is the movie she's talking about, which I'll never name, didn't change, right? It didn't change from when she thought it was directed by a Black person, directed by a white person. So if a Black person made this movie frame for frame, shot for shot, I would have read it completely differently.
100%. Me too. I mean, yeah. For sure.
And that, unfortunately, or fortunately, is, is it unfortunate? It's just the reality. And I can get to what my thought process behind unfortunately and fortunately in a second, but that is just the reality that in modern art, in modern media, modern culture, and modern commercialism, artists are not anonymous.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to always be anonymous. I've written things under pseudonyms before. Like, I just don't want me to be judged for what's on the page. But sure. I think that's not realistic. I think that's not, and I'm not really even sure if it's progressive anymore. I think it might be part of the problem. So I that's kind of where I came from when I went, unfortunately, fortunately, but yeah, if it were written, directed by a Black person, suddenly the James Toback character is pure satire.
Then the Brett Ratner becomes satire.
He's not a person trying to figure out where he fits in this world.
Right.
And the thing about him that's so interesting, he takes the Brooke Shields character and he's very clearly saying, you don't fit in this world. He takes the five kids from the private school and says, you don't fit in this world. He takes Ben Stiller definitely doesn't fit in this world, right? He takes Claudia Schiffer and he says, he takes Claudia Schiffer and he says, you might fit in this world. There might be a place for you. He takes himself and says, you might fit in this world. There might be a place for you.
Sure.
And he takes Brett Ratner and says, you fit in this world.
Yeah.
You fit. This is what it looks like to fit in this world. And that's interesting and weird. And another step on the road you were talking about of him trying to figure out a way for James Toback to maintain his toe-backiness,
yeah,
while also maintaining his, like, you know, not morality, like, sense of self. Like, this is... I got two ratings for this. Kemi, I don't know if you know, this is the end of the podcast. We do a rating.
Oh, and okay.
I'm tempted to rate it twice. I'm tempted to give, like, two different ratings because there are two different things going on in my head.
I also want to talk about something that I was completely confused on and tried to have a take on, but just failed. What the fuck was going on with the husband?
No, I wanted to talk about that too, Kemi, because I want to talk about the movies that Robert Downey Jr. is in and the movie that Ben Stiller is in, because yeah, they're not in this movie.
No, I don't have a take on it either. Actually.
I was like, what is that character? Like, was it supposed to be comedic relief? Well,
apparently, from what I read, that Robert Downey Jr. wanted to play a different role in the movie. I'm not sure which one. And then they came up with this character.
He wanted to play Raekwon.
I don't know.
Like, we're going to get Raekwon. <It's> like,
but long story short, it seemed as though Robert Downey Jr. and Toback came up with this character, and then he had no lines. So everything that Robert Downey Jr. does on his own sort of improvised, I can only assume under the influence performance, that is what it is. It doesn't fit in the movie. It feels like the whole thing is a buildup to Toback forcing him to hit on Mike Tyson and just see what happens.
Yeah.
That feels like that's the whole kind of thing. And I'll say this, that scene is a moment, like, you're watching it and you're just like, I don't know what the fuck I'm watching. And I know that Tyson's not in on it to a certain degree because there's an imbalance in that conversation that's got a tension that I can't really explain. But I don't understand what it has to do with anything in this movie. Like, you could pull Robert Downey Jr. out of this movie and lose, for all intents and purposes, nothing.
Because even the scene on the boat when he's hitting on... was just also... I mean, did I chuckle? I surely did. But... but, I mean, I like that... The reason that scene made me chuckle was, like, how he was pointing out, like, really toxic masculinity of, like, sure, how do I walk? How do I walk? What, you know?
Yeah, but it was funny.
I just didn't understand what that was about and how, why was she so shocked? And then,
well, I want to kind of piggyback on that, Kemi, because it leads into something that I wanted to talk to you guys about, which is directors that use quote unquote improvisation, because there are some filmmakers that don't write a script at all, right? You're Wong Kar-wai's, you're Mike Lee's to a certain degree, where to them, the beauty is in the finding it, right? And creating that crackle and that intangibility of human interaction. And they're able to build a sandbox and create an environment that allows for that to feel really beautiful and poetic on screen. That's not what James Toback is doing here. And when improvisation doesn't feel that way, it has an awkwardness and it has a lack of it doesn't feel genuine. It feels intensely, you know, not genuine.
Yeah.
And this movie, it thinks that it's creating that energy and it's not. So what happens is it all just sort of feels like scenes that you're not really sure why you're watching them.
Kemi, as an actor and director, you can speak to it, like, and a writer.
You mean a director, actor.
I mean a director, writer, producer, friend, actor.
Actor, come on. Well,
I'm interested in the answer to this question from all facets. Yes.
As am I.
The industry you
So here, as a director, I love improv, and I think that there is just something you get from the actors. One, they're just more in tune with each other, because there's something that actors, we do, you know, you read the script, you plan how you're going to say it, whether you like it or not, you know, you've been rehearsing it with someone else, you kind of like have figured out where things fit in. But I think when you improv, like you're clued in because you have no choice. You don't know what the fuck the other person's going to say. As a writer, I think sometimes when I see scenes like that, it's almost a mockery of writing and the skill that it takes and the craft that it takes, because there is what basically what you're describing is there's no turn in any of these scenes. It's just like improv. What I do is I always do like a couple of takes with the script, and then I'll do a take where I'm like, you have to say this line, the beginning, and then the middle line, which is usually where the turn is, and then the end. So at least it gives them a little bit of a roadmap. So even within the improv, they're going to have some sort of turn. But I will say 9 times out of 10, you take the improv take. Just actors.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're speaking of like rails, right? Like you're giving structure to a scene so that it has a fucking point. Right? So like, I mean, one of the filmmakers that I think is an interesting way to look at this is Judd Apatow, right? Where Judd Apatow kind of, now comedy is different to a certain degree, but he kind of goes into a scene, he knows what he wants to get out of it, and then he just kind of rolls camera for hours on end and finds a bunch of funny stuff to fill it in. And it can make it, from a pacing perspective, can make his films feel lumpy, but it's worth it because he hopes that you're laughing at some of the jokes along the way.
Yeah.
This, to your point, with these scenes not having a turn, like look at that, specifically that Robert Downey Jr. scene where it's like, it's got a thesis. It's got like an idea behind like what he wants them to talk about, but it never boils to a point, which is kind of this movie, right?
Yeah.
Which is that it has a thesis, it has ideas of which it wants to speak to, and yet it never kind of makes a point.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, so, I think that there's something to
one more scene. Sorry, that I thought was so dope in the classroom where they're like talking about everyone and the kids are like, ba-da-da-da-da. And everyone's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And then the one chick who from the ghetto and is talking about like, no, we're trying to get out. And then like seeing her roll her eyes and everyone.
Yeah, her eyes at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought, to be honest,
it's a great scene.
The best scene of the movie.
Well, because that's the movie, right? Like in one scene, it encapsulates the entire thing. You also have Jared Leto for no reason, which also feels like it kind of encapsulates this movie. And it just like it really does feel like, OK, you nailed it. Like you nailed what you wanted to do there. And then he jams in all this other shit to kind of fill out a feature, honestly. Like the Ben Stiller stuff, which is the most plot the movie has, which it feels so shoehorned in there with this murder and this cop and Joey Pants playing this DA. And you're just like, what is, and Ben Stiller, who honestly, like if there was a sniper rifle off camera, I wouldn't be surprised. Like he feels so forced to be in this movie. It's like, what is he
maybe
doing?
Maybe he is. First on Robert Downey Jr. Obviously James Toback is not secure enough to talk about sexuality. Like clearly, right? Like it was more or less a punchline. Like it certainly was a punchline at the end. Jared Leto is in the movie to be a landing point for Robert Downey Jr.'s character. He shows up at this club where his fucking students are. Why is he there?
Why?
So that is that one thing. I actually thought Ben Stiller was pretty good, particularly in the scene with Joey Pants in the bar where he goes on and on and on about the story that wound up actually having a point and wound up kind of hitting me in the feels. So like I just
want to be clear. I don't think Ben Stiller's bad in the movie. I don't think that his performance is bad. I just don't know what he's doing in the movie.
And the whole thing makes no sense. I totally agree with that.
The outfit.
It is the glasses. He looks ridiculous.
My favorite shot is where the camera's like rising and he's like.
he's doing a parody of something that like is just not of this world, right? Like
yeah.
So he's like, I was like,
and the fact that he dated Claudia Schiffer is also amazing.
I know. Sorry. Them walking together was amazing. But like, I was a gambler. I was a criminal. Then they decided to make me a cop, and she hated me for it. But the thing that I really like on a structural level, like, you know, if this movie was good, and I'm not saying it's not good, but I mean, but if it was just like, you know, binary good, I would or moral good, I would just have a big problem with this movie being almost a tapestry for the first hour of people living in New York, and then a very kind of specific, focused, simple story about, you know, revenge, or about, you know, about snitching and revenge and the police and all that, you know, kind of typical crime stuff. I also will say, like, that movie that existed for the last half hour isn't such a bad movie either. And there was tension in those scenes that, I was actually engaged with. So, like, if it makes you feel something, maybe it's good. But, like, I can see how the way I was manipulated and all that stuff. And ultimately, you know, the insidiousness of white guy Will committing the crime for black guy Rich, you know, to be more, quote unquote, black. And then getting off because he's, you know, well-born is kind of...
I mean, I think that for me, it's... I agree with everything you're saying, Kenny. I don't actually necessarily think that the scenes that Ben is in are bad, nor do I think that that storyline is necessarily bad or executed poorly. It kind of comes back to what I was saying up top, which is it just feels like a kitchen sink. He's just not focused on anything. The movie's so unfocused that you find yourself kind of locking into scenes and moments that as we've been talking about, but as a whole, you're just like, but what does it all mean? And you know, what was I really supposed to take away from this? And I don't feel necessarily any connection to any of the characters emotionally, right? Like, they all feel like ciphers for an idea as opposed to a character. So there's no one in this movie that I felt genuinely any sort of emotional resonance with.
I felt that way about the girl, the student.
She was great.
But to your point, like, I think that scene did everything, and then everything was like, let's beat it over. Like, he never ever like went further than that. Even that scene where I don't know anyone's name. Where she's like talking about her thesis and she's like, why aren't you listening to me? I thought brilliant, because that is something white people do. Like, look at the work I'm doing in racism. And it's just like, this guy's actually dealing with something about, he's like, I'm living this life. Oh. I don't need to listen to it. And so I feel like Kenny in many ways, because there are, to me, things that are brilliant. And even the ending about this kid that is trying to be black and then does this quote unquote black thing because he associates black with crime, but then never ever having to suffer or pay the consequences of crime, to me is the exact thing. It's like, yes, you do get to put on a costume. Yes, you will never be black because you never have to deal with the consequences of being black in America.
And to further that thesis that you just, you know, that you just laid out is not bad if it didn't end in such a way where it felt like the happy ending are the people separating, going to their own corners, dad and sons reuniting, everybody's happy again. Like, that's what's...
But isn't that America?
I'm not saying it's not, but I am saying that I think the movie comes down on the idea of ultimately, like, white people should do their white guy shit, black people should do their black guy shit, and the white guy shit is, you know, the white guy shit is solving crimes and putting criminals away, and the black guy shit is doing crimes and being in jail. So, like, I think that, like, you know, at the end, I just go, whoa, is this like an argument for segregation? Because, like, I don't think he meant that, because I truly think he got lost in the, I'm gonna write a story. I'm gonna have a plot here. to, you know, use a boss's difference between story and plot. He's like, I'm going to get plotty here. But, and I think he got a little lost in it, because I can't imagine at the end of the day he decided – I can't imagine at the end of the day James Toback was like, you know what? White people say below 96th Street, black people say above 96th Street, we'll be fine.
Yeah.
I
mean,
isn't the closing
shot for like... Shields just – actually, when you say it, the opening shot and the closing shot kind of – about like first is like
the last shot of the film is not the Brooke Shields Elijah Wood tongue kiss, but it's fucking close. Like it's okay. Basically like because the movie ends with like credits and then like a mosaic of shots around the world kind of thing to try to kind of tie everybody together. This is a perfect example. What are we supposed to take away from the fact that at the end of this movie, Brooke Shields ends up with Elijah Wood? Who, by the way, has two lines in this movie, maybe three lines in this movie. Like, I don't know what, other than the fact that he's like, this is shocking, or this is kind of, you didn't see this coming, or I don't know what, like, I just,
you didn't see
this is kind of, you know, like, it's very strange.
Yeah.
It's, I was thinking about the scenes between Dean and Claudia Schiffer. When he's sort of grappling with taking the money from Ben Stiller and all that sort of stuff.
I must mention, as a lifelong Knicks fan, that Dean is played by Alan Houston, who at the time was the best player on the Knicks. So,
okay.
And he did a fine job. And he wasn't He wasn't particularly beloved either. You know, that was the 99 Knicks where it was Latrell Sprewell's team, and Alan Houston, like, just wasn't. Alan Houston was a great player, but Alan Houston was not a beloved Knick the way Latrell Sprewell was. So, and the Knick fans are wonderful, and they have a tendency to, you know, gravitate towards the more exciting.
I actually thought he was quite good in it.
He did
great. His acting. Like, he did specifically the scene he has with Will when he's about to get shot at the end. He does a real that scene is surprisingly effective, considering that it shouldn't be.
It's interesting that James Toback used an actual athlete for that role. You know, someone having worked for a show where we use actual athletes for shit, like I know the James Tobacks of the world who just want a fucking picture of themselves next to the best player in New York to hang on their, you know, office wall or their, you know, fucking, you know, post on the 99 version of Instagram. So there's a lot to that.
99 version.
You certainly didn't need, I mean, like, Morris Chestnut tall enough, you know what I mean? Like, you certainly didn't need to, like,
especially because there were shots of them playing basketball. I'd understand that, you know? But it's like, you could have just used a tall-ass actor.
Yeah.
But he was good in the scene when he's trying to talk Will not, you know, talk him out of killing him. And actually, I would argue that that is the most visually well-shot sequence in that movie. The colors are beautiful. They did a great saturation.
Yeah.
The spiral staircase, that overhead shot. Even if I don't completely understand where he shot him, how he shot him, and why
and how he
as
fell
much as he was,
on top.
And how
know.
He fell. That doesn't make any sense.
That's physics, Kemi. Like, I mean, when you see someone, they fall always
they fall
against the momentum of the bullet. That's
because you know that, you are now invited to the cookout. All you gotta do is shoot someone. All right,
I got this on a podcast. I'm gonna go in. I'm gonna hold up the audio. Oh yeah.
So here's I have a question for you guys. Apparently, this is Michael B. Jordan's first movie. Did you catch him in this movie?
Where was he?
Maybe he was one of the first three kids, because he was a little baby in 99.
Maybe he was one of the kids. He probably was.
His first movie. Y'all, I don't know what to tell.
I do have a meeting soon.
Wait, you have a meeting with him?
No, just in general.
Like, she needs to get off of this podcast, Kemi, which is an amazing thing to say.
Is it at 12, Kemi?
No, it was at 11:30. I thought this was an hour and a half. How long does this go? How long is it? 2 hours?
Listen, it goes as long as you want, but this is my favorite thing that ever happened on the podcast. We've never had a guest that just legit be like, I gotta go.
Listen, I can push it. What time do you normally end it?
Well, we tend to go about 2 hours, but you know, we get to this zone where we're just kind of having fun.
Okay, you know what? Let me tell them.
Tell Michael B.
No, don't apologize. This is fantastic. Michael, this is great behind the curtain.
Listen to Michael B. Jordan. Sorry, Michael.
I mean, either way, we've talked about the plot of this movie, so we don't really need to talk about it.
I mean,
the plot,
we can wrap this up. Is it Will on this podcast or Ernie? Like, we can just cut this stuff out.
I'm going to just take a photo so he knows I'm serious. It's fine.
No. Well, I mean, listen. I think we were done. Nearing the wrap up in terms of
you got to keep that in but, as well. Me being like,
yeah,
no,
we're doubling it. Yeah, no.
Yeah, I'm busy.
We have a director on this podcast. Okay,
listen, I'm busy directing, writing, producing, and acting.
So I do want to say this though, because it's funny that the last shot of the film, Kemi, that you alluded to earlier, is not the second to last shot is Brooke Shields and Elijah Wood making out. The last shot is Brett Ratner directing the hip hop music video. So
yes,
that's where the movie really kind of wants to say, this is the enduring thing that I want to stick with you. This is the thing I want you to leave the theater thinking about, which is Brett Ratner bopping his head to Raekwon.
I don't know this fact at all, but I'm just going to guess that I bet a lot of those like music videos in the 90s were directed by white men.
Without a doubt. I think that's a safe assumption. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, Ratner did a lot. Guy named Dave Myers did a lot. Like a lot of Asian guys, actually. Justin Lin did a lot.
Nice.
Who's the other director from Fast and the Furious? He's the guy from Saw, James Wan. But there were definitely a lot in the 90s. And then, you know, of course, there were, you know, your Hype Williams, who, you know, the one people remember because he had a visual style. But just to kind of continue on this theme of the rap music, I really do want to also talk about Wu-Tang, because Wu-Tang is not your average rap group. Wu-Tang is not your average entity, not just from the way they make music, which is different. You know, they're a collective, and basically RZA put together a very large group of people, not just like the 9 or I think 8 original members and then the other members that came on, but we're talking about like 20, 30, 40 people who can claim Wu-Tang without being a liar in that period of time. The other thing about one other thing about Wu-Tang is Wu-Tang is so quintessentially New York, right? In a way that even Biggie isn't. Like, Wu-Tang is in the fabric of New York, right? And most of these guys never left. They mostly still live in Staten Island, and some of them have gone on to be massive stars like Method Man or Ghostface or those people. I mean, Raekwon. RZA is obviously, like, has as many hyphens as Kemi. So, like, they're... Riz is a thing all to himself now. Riz is a director. Riz is a music supervisor. Riz is an actor. Riz is, you know, in movies big and small. But the thing that Wu-Tang in 99 denoted more than I think any other rapper, any other rap group, was credibility. And Toback signing on with Wu-Tang, and they were very instrumental in the writing of this movie. Oliver Grant was an associate of Wu-Tang. Oliver Grant started WuWare. Oliver Grant was, you know, a self-made millionaire on his own through the WuWare label. Like, then that guy played Power, or Rich Power, Power. Signing out with Wu-Tang was some serious cover in and of itself, and probably deflected a ton of criticism at the time. Because if Wu-Tang is okay with this, you should be too.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And then Raekwon was obviously the main rapper in this. He was called Cigar in the movie. There were Wu-Tang members up and down. Method Man had a speech, a very modern speech about how oppression still, you know, lived then, lives now. But you can't kind of talk about this without talking about Wu-Tang. Sorry.
And now I'm really going to get fired. But, I mean, can I get fired from a job I'm not on? But I think this is the same way. Let's take this to the writer's room, okay? You have Black writers in your writer's room to do the exact same function as Wu-Tang. And it's like, well, we have Black writers in the room. But it's like, am I writing the story? Do I actually have the power? Does Wu-Tang have the power in that movie? And like, let's be honest, am I in a position to say no to a check? No, I am not, you know? And so I always hate it, especially like, okay, I don't mind saying this. Okay, Tyler Perry. there was some like criticism about some Tyler Perry show called Sisters, right? And then they were interviewing the actresses, like, there are some criticisms. What do you think? I think that's so unfair to do, because I'm not going to say, I'm not going to critique the hand that signs my check, you know? And yet, I feel like people are used in those situations to be like, see, they're okay with it. No, what they're okay with is getting a check, you know?
There's no question about that.
Right, right.
Right? Like, I mean, we need to air out our own, you know, kind of laundry, but Kim and I work on a show where there are four writers of color, two Black writers, and you can read between the lines. We've seen this up close, and it's your point is obviously correct and well taken, but I think people have known that for a while, you know, the whole Black friend thing. And I think that, you know, that's been like going around for a good 15 years, the notion of diversity hires and the notion of getting paid less and the notion of getting paid by the studio, the notion of just being there so you can say, this is my Black person, this Black person's okay yeah. with this, you know, this blackface sketch on 30 Rock, so we're fine. Something I don't think people don't know about are Black passes. And that's what Wu-Tang did. Wu-Tang gave this movie a Black pass, and by that I mean that in a writer way, right? Like, we're gonna mm-hmm. Black this script up.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think happens all over the fucking industry for much less money than a polish or much less money than a, you know, a rewrite or a, you know, a spec, and is something that people should really think long and hard about what they're doing mm-hmm. in asking someone to come in for $5,000 to give a quote unquote Black pass to a Black script instead of having that same person write the first draft.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think what they're saying is, I know how to tell your story better. I just need you to write the word nigga in it. That's all they're saying. Because then they can't be, no one can say like, oh, they used the N word. No. That came in the Black pass. You know, and I also think that Black passes serve as a safety net, right? Because any issue you have a problem with, which is why I'm always cautious about them and I've never done them, is any issue that arises in that film, people are going to say it was a person who did the Black pass, right? And also, you don't have as much power in a Black pass. All you can do is change dialogue. You're pretty much a punch up. You're just punching up, right?
Yeah.
You can't change the storyline. It's not like you're going to give yourself more agency. And so I think that's a very good thing to bring up, because I think, but again, it's a check. And I'm not saying that people should be doing things for money or that it's okay to do things that harm, that have like negative narratives for money. But I understand what it's like to need a check. And someone is like, here's this thing, you can write it. And of course they sell it to you differently, right? They're like, we want to show how white people are, da, 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 da. And you can see it like that. But until you see the film, you're like, I don't know. I mean, I still don't know if the film is problematic. I mean, it is, but I don't know. You know, I don't know.
You're there for step five of a 20-step process.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't know any. You couldn't possibly know anything. And that's the other thing that, you know, you're saying, which is essentially, yeah, okay, so 25-ish years ago, studios started the diversity programs. And as a way to get writers of color or other marginalized writers, so people with handicaps or whatever, into writers' rooms. And I understand, of course, there were noble intentions, noble-ish. But what I think this moment is about is understanding that if you actually have those intentions, the prescriptions we've been prescribing have not been working and have not been adequate and have not been correct. And to put it upon a Black writer to turn down a paycheck instead of putting on a white producer or a white studio head or white network head to say, no, this show should be written by a Black person is those are the people, A, with the power and B, with nothing to lose.
Yeah.
Like you have nothing to lose. Like that's the thing. So I really, and just to go one step further, like I recognize how hard it is to be a showrunner. And I recognize you can't just become a showrunner tomorrow. So you can't take a playwright from New York or from Atlanta and say you are now a showrunner because it's just not like that. But you can take a playwright from New York or Atlanta or a short filmmaker or anybody, a comedian, and say you are now a show creator and we will pair you up with a showrunner.
Yes.
Because that happens every fucking day. And I'll grant it's happening a lot more than it used to happen. Michaela Cole's a good example, right? But
she showrunned her stuff from get-go. Michaela Cole writes, directs, acts in every single episode you've ever seen.
Yes. Michaela, that's what I'm saying. Michaela Cole is someone who can come on the scene at a top level with a producer who will make her HBO show with her, not for her, and not taking it from her, right? Yeah. And that's the thing we can be doing. I feel like we have focused way too much on the staffing aspect of it and not nearly enough on the creating aspect of it.
Yeah.
Right? Like the stat, even the high level staffing, like it matters.
It does, because here's the main issue with those diversity hires is that like the studios are paying for it. So they're like, all right, well, an extra body, sure, bring it. Yeah. But no one's promoting, right? And then I've been told in a room, I don't know if you were there, Kemi, but literally one of the higher levels was like, we love our diversity hires. Like, we love Kemi. I'm not a diversity hire. I'm not a diversity hire. Like, I'm literally not.
That's awful. I'm sorry, but I don't mean to laugh, but I'm sorry.
It's funny. On two points, I'm not a diversity hire. I didn't go through a diversity program. So he's like, I don't know why they wouldn't promote them. Like, we love our diversity hires. We love Kemi. And then he mentioned a writer from last season. And I'm like, well, one, I'm not a diversity hire. And two, how rich of you to call me the diversity on a Black show? You're the diversity. What the fuck?
How about mentioning someone from, I mean, God, now, thank God we're 2 hours in, no one will listen to this. But how about mentioning someone from last year who is no longer there?
But
on top of that, like, Lionsgate doesn't do that. So it's not,
but the fact that he saw a Black writer and saw me as a diversity hire is just talking to what you're talking about. It's like, oh, the little color in the room, right? And I think, you know, one thing that I have learned, like, from the two rooms, I used to think that being in a room, like, you had a lot of power and you have suggestion power, but ultimately you're writing in the voice of, I know this sounds so obvious, but it just clicked. Like, you're actually writing in the voice of the showrunner. So you, whoever that showrunner is, you're writing in their voice, because ultimately it's like, yes, no, I like that, you know. And so it goes to your point, Kenny, of there's so much focus on staffing, but no one is looking at the top level. And to what you were saying about, you can't bring a playwright from New York and make them showrun. It just doesn't work. What you can do is promote people, you know.
It really comes down to, if you want to change things, you have to put people in the position of power to actually change things. It's the people that can green light a project. It's the people that are in control of the creative voice of a show.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where, you know, that's where we're lacking. That's where the industry needs to make serious changes. And that's where, you know, the tide has to turn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Woo. So Kenny, do you want to rate this movie?
I'm going to rate it. Never seen this movie before. Kemi, I know you haven't either, but normally we do. If you've seen it before, 99.
Well, do you want to explain to Kemi how the rating works?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So you normally do it. If you've seen it before, you'll give a rating. Then you'll give a rating before this podcast and after this podcast.
Mm.
All right. So this is a perplexing movie to rate. And I was perplexed after I watched it. I said, how do you rank a movie that dares to tackle a topic too taboo for almost anyone to acknowledge seriously, but the conclusions it draws are ultimately pretty dangerous, which is how I feel. I gave it a 40 before this podcast. So it's 1 out of 99, Kemi.
I love that.
Thank you. Most people are like, not 100.
That's stupid.
Well, we normally have really stupid guests on. So we do.
They're clearly not multi hyphenates. That's why.
No. So I'm actually gonna bump it up. I'm gonna bump it up to a 48, and it's 50 is generally the demarcation line between recommend and don't recommend. I can't recommend it as a movie that you should be watching, but I can recommend it as a very interesting cultural document and also an interesting, albeit potentially unintentional, self-dissection of James Toback. Mm. So there's a lot there that we were able to sink our teeth into, but I don't walk away from this movie being like, that's a great movie that I think that I want my recommendation on. So I get Roger Ebert's 2-star review.
I will say that I started lower than you, but I landed basically at the same place. I started at a 30, and now I'm at a 49. I similarly to you, Kenny, I can't in good conscience recommend this to people because I don't think that it's a particularly effective piece of filmmaking. From you know, 30,000 feet. I think there's stuff in it that, as we've talked about, has bumped this up almost 20 points for me in terms of just there's an intellectualism and there are goals that this film is striving for that I commend and I guess on some level I'm glad it exists, but I can't say that it works as a movie for me. But I respect the attempt and I respect the sort of the unintentional metatextuality that Toback brought to this. This has been not just a phenomenal episode and a great conversation, but it really has sort of made me reevaluate Toback and perhaps what his goals were as a filmmaker to a certain degree. So I appreciate that. But what did you think, Kemi?
I'm going to give it 2 ratings. My first rating is if it was a black director.
Okay, great. Great.
If it was a black director, I would have rated 55.
Okay.
And only because I, you know, to be honest, even as is, I do think there are conversations in that film that people aren't having, you know, and I think it's, if you watch it with the idea that it's problematic, I think you need to, I would recommend watching it, but knowing it's problematic, because I think it's a great conversation starter. I mean, like, look at this podcast. Like, I think it brings up a lot of interesting things that are so relevant right now, specifically today. And that's sad. And I think that's where the brilliance is. And also, I just like watching wild shit. Like, wow, the audacity. Yeah, I'm gonna put it at a 51, because I think you should watch it, but no, it's problematic, you know.
I as you were talking,
I'm
giving it a 52. I like,
it just tipped. Yeah,
it was like, it's the same exact, because like 48 was intentional. and 52. Yeah. It's that you flipped it for me.
Yeah, so, like I'm glad I watched it. You know, I didn't feel like give me my hour and 40 minutes back. I was like, this is fascinating. Problematic.
Yeah, you've convinced me as well. I've tipped over the 50 yard line on this one too. Yeah. I think that.
What are you going? Phil? If you look, what's your number? Is it 51?
It's 50.
50. Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know what? There we go. 50, 51, 52.
I say that in the sense that, because I think you said it best, like it might be the most like this is a document movie that we've done so far, Kenny, like that it's almost out of the realm of whatever it is. And it's now this thing that you need to kind of watch, not even just as a conversation starter, which it clearly is, but also just in terms of like a document of 99 of what that was and what race perhaps meant then. And also to look at it through that lens now, it does become a lot more fascinating if you go into it knowing that it is a problematic movie for sure.
Yeah.
Shit, Cammy. Nice job. You were great. I knew you'd be great. I had no doubt. But
this was fun.
So next week, we're doing Mystery Alaska with Bart Nickerson is coming on. Have you seen the movie Mystery Alaska, Cammy, by any chance?
I have not.
The very white hockey movie that David E. Kelly wrote. Jay Roach.
White is a lot of coke.
Yeah. There you go. David E. Kelly of Big Little Lies?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that that's the associate. Yes.
I also, love like
8 million television shows from the 90s.
Kemi is 17 years old, so you know.
Listen, I was introduced to him on that, and I loved it. I loved it a lot. All right.
I mean, that's what we're doing next week. Thank you so much for coming on, Kemi. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kemi.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.